This is CBS, Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor. I am in the Gannon Room of the Army Navy Club Library on the third deck. I am sitting with three gentlemen to ponder the question of the defense of Taiwan. The threats against Taiwan are constant. They're directed at a people and an idea of democracy. They're meant to intimidate the people of Taiwan, but also to keep back Japan, Australia, Europe, NATO, and especially the United States. It's not worth it. We're going to do this. It's our 10th province. There are all kinds of nonsensical words. Let's go to the people of Taiwan, because I'm sitting with three gentlemen to help me imagine this catastrophe. Jerry Hendricks, author of To Provide and Maintain a Navy, U.S. Navy retired aviator, Why Naval Primacy is America's First Best Strategy. Rear Admiral Edward Sonny Masso, Executive Director of the Naval Historical Foundation. And Bridge Colby, Elbridge Colby of the Marathon Initiative. The new book is The Strategy of Denial, American Defense in an Age of Great Power Conflict. I anticipate Beijing has read plenty of this already, Bridge, so let's go to it. The people of Taiwan, first of all, are they ready to dig in? What does that invasion fleet look like coming across the narrow waters? And in your book, you make the bloody-minded point that that is the point of most leverage when the fleet's crossing to land on the beach. We all sound like Rommel. Stop them on the beach, you can't stop them. Is that it, Bridge?
Well, I would say that the Taiwanese people are unfortunately not ready. And this is they hold their fates in their hands, and I've said this to them directly. The single most important factor in whether or not Taiwan will survive as a free society is Taiwan's own efforts. They need to dramatically increase their level of defense spending and focus in on the right things, which is resisting an invasion and surviving a blockade and bombardment along the lines of what Great Britain was willing to do in 1940. So, you know, if they're not prepared before that invasion fleet launches from the southern coast of China, then it's too late. They need to prepare now dramatically.
They're preparing. We're going to leap to that. The fleet's coming. Mm-hmm. There are weaknesses in the Chinese plan. What are they, Bridge?
Well, I don't know. But at the end of the day, and these gentlemen are experts on, I mean, launching and sustaining an amphibious invasion across 100 plus nautical miles of water is no easy feat. It can be done. We've been able to do it for 70 years following the Pacific War. But in the face of a prepared and capable defense, it's very, very difficult. So that's the best time to get them is when they're on their way over in fat transports, whether by sea or air. And you attack them all the way. You attack those forces that land, and you attrit and degrade those that land, and you hit those that are loading in their ports of embarkation and so forth. But you use every opportunity. But I think our best vantage, and this is the thing, I mean, I can say this with less bias than these gentlemen, but look, the strong suit of the United States as a military is naval and aerospace power. I mean, if you look at our generally democracies, you know, Great Britain, ourselves, our strong suit as militaries is not mass, you know, warfare along the lines of the Eurasian great powers. Our strong suit is technology, high investment, naval and air and high technology warfare. And so we should look to exploit that advantage and double down on wherever possible.
Admiral, I call upon you because history here informs me of the Battle of Leyte Gulf, which I'm told the Navy regards as their Shakespeare moment. The exposure of the invasion fleet to the Japanese plan, the pincer plan, and Admiral Halsey and others misreading the situation, leaving the invasion fleet vulnerable. It didn't happen. The catastrophe didn't happen. But in Bridge's book, he proposes something that was quite fetching to me. It hadn't occurred to me that after the invasion fleet launches, after it lands on the island of Taiwan, it's got to maintain a force on the ground by resupplying in some fashion. That was always the problem for invasion. Is the American fleet in a position, not on the first day, but the second day and the third day and after that, to deny the supplies that the Chinese will need on Taiwan?
I think the short answer to that is I would go with yes, but I would. Here's my caveat. Leyte Gulf's an interesting comparison in Guadalcanal, which was an example in the first Battle of Savo Island, where it was to disrupt supply chain and was successful. Norm Scott and Daniel Judson Callahan being heroes of that battle. In Leyte Gulf, I think we had diversity of command. You had an element led by MacArthur and an element led by Nimitz, and they had subtly different objectives, but nonetheless. But I think one area that we've got to concentrate on, we have not really discussed it in this wonderful discussion, is how we use our allies and how we rely on them and how we start, you know, we're gaming this right now with them with live exercises. And so we've got dear friends in South Korea. We have dear friends in Japan. We have dear friends with capability in Australia. They have Aegis. They have capabilities such as sensor netting. But I think that the best play for us in the defense of Taiwan is to employ all of our technology to have the indications and warnings that give us, you know, weeks, months in advance heads up on what we think is going to come, and then shepherd our forces and get over there in a large footprint.
Jerry, China wins the first day. Who wins the second day?
Well, that's really the key question. I mean, if you look at the Normandy operations plan, you know, it's a 6-inch thick binder. And one of the key lessons of that, and anyone who reviews it, is that, you know, that ship that is bringing across men and supplies on day one has a job every other day for the next 28 days in order to gain lodgment and keep those people at shore. That's why the precursor operations, sweeping the English Channel for mines and hunting all the submarines in it, were so critical ahead of the Normandy invasion, because the loss of that one ship, if you lost a ship on day one, not only did you lose that ship and its crew, but you lost it for the next 28 days of that operation. Anything that we take out early in this process, whether it's one of their crew or their manned ferries, or whether it's an equipment barge, that complicates the long-term plan for the Chinese. That's why it's important to invest in things like anti-submarine warfare or submarines that can sink ships, or the types of missiles or mines. Mines are the every man's cheapest weapon. And so if Taiwan was investing in mines that could mine that space, and mind you, 110 to 120 miles is a lot farther distance. It's a much more complicated challenge to come across than it was to cross the 25 miles from Great Britain to the Normandy coast. We need to make the Chinese pay at every mile across that. That's largely Taiwan investment, but we need to make sure that we're sending them the right equipment. That's one of the things about Bridges' book that's so good, is it highlights the fact that there's a lot of things that the Taiwan military want that's not really that helpful to them in the scenario that we're talking about. We need to guide them towards the systems that they really need, not the things that they want.
Bridge, I think I remember correctly that you, in your book, present the case that the Taiwanese dig in and do not surrender after the overrunning attack, and give the time to the Navy and our allies. There'll be other people coming in, but it takes time, and you're operating in a hostile theater. They dig in and hold on and deny the Chinese overwhelming success. In what timeline, Bridge? Did you imagine what the timeline?
Well, I don't know. I mean, the preference would be to destroy the fleet before and the air armada before they can land anybody meaningful. But that doesn't necessarily mean that it's impossible that we could win in an alternative way, which is you degrade that invasion armada, air and sea, as it comes over. And then those forces that do land, the key is that you, and this is kind of using army terminology, the key is you deny the Chinese ability to seize and to hold Taiwan's key territory. If the Chinese get on, but they don't have a strong enough stranglehold, they won't be able to support it. Here, an example is Gallipoli. The Anzac forces could land, but they couldn't consolidate the victory, and eventually they were withdrawn or expelled. And that's the kind of model we could look. I don't think this is the same as a stay-behind kind of action. I'm skeptical of the ability of guerrilla forces to present a meaningful challenge to Taiwan. But I think if regular and irregular forces and possibly allied forces were on the ground as well, certainly from the air and sea, were contesting Chinese forces on Taiwan, I think that could work. And in fact, this can be a rational strategy. I go through these a little bit in the book, and others would know more. But, you know, at Iwo Jima, the Japanese met the Marines at the beach, I think partially because Iwo Jima is so small. But in Okinawa, my understanding is they actually deliberately allowed the American forces to come farther in because they thought it was more advantageous. Whether that was right or not, I don't know, although the battle was very hard fought for us, so it must have had some value. But I think that's the kind of thing we should be thinking about. As Jerry exactly rightly said, they should have to pay at every single point, because even a small increment can matter. Because, you know, for want of a shoe, right, the kingdom was lost. I mean, if you can degrade 10% or 20% of the fleet with sea mines, and you can force them to get out of their formation so they become more vulnerable, say, to air and missile attack. That can help, and that's just a matter of degree at every single step.
Sonny, limited war. I read this topic all the time in speculation for Europe, for Ukraine. Limited war. Is there such a thing as a limited war? Once this begins, can you say to the American people, we're only going to go so far and we're not going to use this or we're not going to use that? Does that make sense, Sonny?
I don't think the Powell doctrine of limited war applies in Taiwan. And I really don't believe it applies in the Philippine Islands either. And, you know, I defer to Bridge and his expertise, but I just don't. I think this is one where you're in until it's over. And you have a mindset that, you know, we're not losing. And it's all in. The implications are just radically horrific if we allow Taiwan to be subordinated by China.
The catastrophe is upon us. So we'll pull back because we can't see day two. We can know what is possible on day two. We can't see it. And the Admiral mentioned earlier allies. When we come back, we're going to talk about our allies because there's a new alliance in the world that has rocked the Chinese anticipation of their easy rollover of Taiwan. It's called AUKUS. It's an odd name. But there it is. Australia, United Kingdom, and the United States. What does that mean? I'm speaking with Elbridge Colby, the author of The Strategy of Denial, American Defense in an Age of Great Power Conflict. Edward Sonny Masso, Rear Admiral, U.S. Navy, retired Executive Director of the Naval Historical Foundation. And Captain Jerry Hendricks, the author of To Provide and Maintain a Navy, Why Naval Primacy is America's First Breast Strategy. I'm John Batchelor.
Stay tuned for more of CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.